fists knocked her down. "Hey!" Sugar cried. There were a tangle of legs. The girl was in some kind of panic. She was a comfort mediator too. She was wearing a blue version of the Neo-Weave uniform, indicating that she served the main salon. She was blonde. Sugar couldn't remember her name. They'd met at induction. Maggie, was it? Molly? "Hey!" said Sugar. "What's the matter? Calm down!" The girl was trembling. Her eyes were very wide. She was staring over her shoulder back into the provision store she'd run out of. Sugar tried to hold her steady, but the girl was almost fighting her off. "Calm down!" Sugar cried. "I could see inside it!" the girl exclaimed, her voice very high and whiny. "I could see its insides! Oh, God, help me! It knew my name!" "What?" The girl broke free and ran off down the corridor. She left her winged chrome comfort mediator's helmet rolling like a dying top at Sugar's feet. Sugar watched it rotate to a halt. She thought about picking it up. She thought about going after the girl. She thought about going into the provision store. None of the ideas appealed very much. Sugar had the creeps all of a sudden. What had the girl, Maggie, Molly, been gabbling about? See inside what? At induction, the senior motivation coach had mentioned that there was a very small possibility that some people might become upset or unsettled by the transpositional experience. "We'll be going through the looking glass, remember, people," he had said. "The press isn't calling this a historic voyage for nothing. No one's done this outside laboratory conditions or test beds. There is a possibility that the experience will not suit everybody. They may become disconcerted by secondary phenomena that the scientists haven't even identified yet. That's why all senior mediators will have access to trank farms and the med lockers. Just keep your eyes open, be sensitive and be thoughtful. If you see a transfer client starting to panic, go to your core training and calm them. Alert your senior. If it's bad, alert the control crew and the onboard doctor." What happens if it's another mediator who freaks? Sugar thought. What then, eh? Sugar straightened her uniform. The major freakout she most urgently needed to defuse wasn't some general deck mediator's hysterics. It was Joseph Stern's Cluxton's champagne-related meltdown. She stepped into Provision Store 1. The premium bottles were racked in a foam-lined, climate-controlled cellar along the end wall. She activated a little follow-me artificial, a wheeled robot not much larger than a child's cart. It rolled out of its recharger wall socket obediently and slaved itself to her bio-signal, rolling after her as if it was attached to her by an invisible leash. She fitted it with a three-bucket cryo-hopper and slid in the bottles that Lizzie had told her to get out of the cellar. The gold-foiled necks of the expensive bottles stuck up out of the hopper's buckets. The buckets began to frost up as the cryo system kicked in. Sugar opened a big larder cooler and selected a box of chilled champagne flutes. She turned back to load them onto the Follow Me's carrier. They were expensive glasses, lead crystal. They made a very loud noise when they broke. The box flew out of Sugar's hands as she recoiled in surprise. Something had appeared in front of her, just 3 or 4 meters away in the middle of the storage space. It was just there, hovering above the ground at about hip height. It looked like a small sphere of mercury, a gleaming silver droplet that shifted and rolled around on itself with a fluid, viscous pulse. But it was getting bigger. It was growing even as she stared at it, her eyes wide, her mouth open, and her heart racing faster than even an interstitial transposition vehicle. As the writhing sphere grew, it began to look less like quicksilver and more like molten glass, heavy and swollen, clear as water with embers inside it. It was as if the sphere, whatever it was extruding into the air in front of her from somewhere else, like a bubble of water through a faulty seal. Sugar was aware of a noise, like a distant voice. Someone calling out from very far away. The sphere kept growing. It had expanded to the size of a beach ball, and it was rapidly becoming more than just a sphere. 2 vague spokes were starting to extend from its underside, and the upper part of the sphere was elevating in a blunt column. It was almost beautiful. Sugar had seen traditional glass blowers at work years before on a holiday to Mars. This weird growth looked just like that. Fat, gleaming, translucent mass that oozed and altered as gravity played upon its dense form. And, like the inflating blob on the end of a glassblower's pipe, there was colour in its depth, the orange glow of molten heat. except it was not so much orange as red. It wasn't heat, it was blood. Sugar let out a squeak of dismay as she realized that she could see blood and connective tissue and internal organs alive and pulsing, forming inside the fluxing shape. She could see anatomical structures. She was looking at a torso with vestiges of hips and thighs below it, just hanging in the air, half formed so that she could see into it through the skin. It was as if someone was slowly becoming visible in front of her from the inside out. Fascination had rooted Sugar to the spot, but as the graphic horror of what she was seeing sank in, fear overcame her. She turned and bolted out of Provision Store 1. The Follow-Me lurched after her, its expensive cargo clinking and rattling. Sugar ran out into the interdeck corridor. She could still hear the sound like a distant voice crying out, like the noise in her auntie's chimney. She skidded to a halt. There was a man standing in front of her. She knew absolutely nothing about him, but he was smiling a cheeky, reassuring smile. "Nice hat," he said. "What? The hat?" he pointed. "Nice, fetching, very Asterix." He had something in his hand, a strange, whirring, pen-shaped device. "There's something in the storeroom," she stammered. "That's only to be expected," he said. "It's a storeroom. You don't understand." He winked at her. "Try me," he said. "Who are you?" Sugar asked. "I'm the doctor," he said. "I didn't send for the onboard doctor," she said. "I'm sure you didn't." "So what do you mean you're the doctor?" she demanded. He hesitated. His tongue wedged thoughtfully in one cheek with an expression on his face that suggested a decent explanation would far exceed any time he had available. "What did you see?" he asked. "What?" "In the storeroom." Sugar gestured frantically and hopelessly. "Something!" she cried. "Oh dear God, it was horrible!" The man pointed the humming device at her. Then he stepped closer to her, nose to nose, and peered down into her eyes. "You've got," he mused, cocking his head. "What is that? An optical data link? Holographic? A lashboard," she replied. "The actuators are woven into my eyelashes." "Could it be that, I wonder?" he asked, gazing into her eyes. "What?"
"Making you see things."
"Are you saying my lashboard is glitching?"
"I'm just saying that it could be interference. What you saw might have been a random imaging artifact."
What?"
"Your lashboard could be glitching," he said.
The man, the doctor, looked up at the ceiling suddenly. "What's your name?" he asked. "Sugar McCauley," said Sugar. "Could you do me a favour, Sugar McCauley?" he asked. "Could you hold on tight?"
"To what?"
she asked, really scared now. "To anything that seems reasonably solid and dependable," he replied. She grabbed his arm.
"Okay," he said.
A second later, the shockwave hit them. There was a bang and a terrible jolt and a furious sound of metal shredding in darkness. Sugar was thrown forwards. Someone said her name. There was a vicious flash of light as if all the lightning in the universe had just been squeezed through a tiny slit. For a moment, a minuscule moment, the ceiling was the floor and the floor was the ceiling. A pink glow flickered around the edges of her vision.
"Oh my God!"
exclaimed Sugar McCauley. She heard a gunshot, and then another, and then another. The three bottles of expensive champagne in the Follow Me's buckets had blown their corks. Pale foam was jetting from the foiled necks. Sugar got to her feet and straightened her winged helmet.
"What just happened?" she asked. "Hard to say," replied the doctor.
He was scanning his device up and down the wall.
"Because I wouldn't understand?" she asked. "Because I'm not sure I understand," the doctor replied. "The ship just hit something."
"It's not a ship," she said.
"It's not?"
Sugar shook her head.
"It's an interstitial transposition vehicle."
The doctor stared at her, his eyes narrowing.
"Is it?" he asked. "Is it really?"
Sugar nodded.
"And what," he asked, "is this particular interstitial transposition vehicle doing today?"
"It's on its maiden voyage," she said. "From Earth Moondocks to Terminal Station Eternity in the Lesser Magellanic Cloud."
"Well, blimey," he said, frowning. "That's a very long journey by anybody's tape measure."
Sugar nodded again.
"It's the longest journey possible, from one end of the human empire to the other."
She stopped speaking and looked at him. He appeared pensive and vaguely worried.
"How can you not know that?" she asked. How can you even be aboard and not know that?"
"Ah," he said,
with an expression that once again seemed to regret that there simply wasn't enough time for a thorough and satisfying exploration of the topic.
"I want to see your boarding card," said Sugar.
"What?"
"I want to see your boarding card," she repeated.
"Oh, look, there's no need to..." he began.
"Show me your boarding card."
All right, said the doctor. He swept a leather wallet out of his pocket and flashed it at her.
"That's not a boarding card," Sugar told him.
"It isn't?"
"No, it isn't anything. It's just blank paper," she said.
The doctor looked at the wallet himself.
"It is, isn't it?" he admitted. "Oh, that's not good. That should never happen to psychic paper."
"What's psychic paper?" Sugar asked.
"Shh," he replied. "You hear that?"
She listened.
She could hear the air circulator plant and the murmur of the transpositional engines. But the murmur was different somehow. It was ragged and more laboured, as if the engines were straining or struggling.
"The engines," she began.
"Not happy," he agreed. "Because we hit something?"
"Because the ship hit something," he said.
"Except it's not a ship," she said.
"Except for that, obviously," he agreed, nodding solemnly.
"Because, as you pointed out, it's an interstitial transposition vehicle, not a ship."
He looked up and around at the fabric of the corridor.
"It's an interstitial transposition vehicle on its maiden voyage through quantum space," he said, more to himself than to her. He seemed to be lost in thought for a moment.
"Are we going to be all right?" Sugar asked.
He blinked and looked at her. An enormous grin lit up his face.
"Us? All right? Oh, yes, no doubt about that, Sugar Macaulay. How can you be so sure? Because I'm always all right," he replied.
She raised her eyebrows.
"Well," he corrected, "almost always, and that's good enough, isn't it? We should check on the rest of the ship. I mean the interstitial transpositional vehicle. After a bump like that, there are bound to be grazed knees and spilled drinks and all kinds of stuff."
He looked back at her.
"You are a flight attendant, aren't you?" he asked, suddenly concerned. "You didn't just put that on this morning for a bet."
"I'm an executive class comfort mediator," she said.
His beaming grin returned. It was warm and delighted.
"Of course you are," he said. "That's brilliant."
Then he was off. Sugar straightened her winged helmet again and ran after him. With a wail of its miniature drivetrain, the Follow Me sped after her, champagne suds still drooling from the necks of the burst bottles like magma from volcanic cones. The doctor paused to look into the galley. She peered in behind him. The artificials had stopped working. They were all frozen at their workstations, their request reset monitor lights blinking. Some food and several utensils had fallen off the workstations onto the deck.
"Robots," said the doctor.
"Everything's automated," Sugar said, "except as mediators. We're part of the luxury package."
"The personal touch," he said.
She nodded.
"Because interstellar trips usually take so long, cabin service is always automated," he reasoned to himself. "But this ship, this interstitial transpositional vehicle, covers the distance so fast you can actually afford to have at-seat service from real humans."
"It's like the halcyon age of travel," Sugar agreed, repeating something she'd read in a Novilunar brochure. "I was so lucky to get this job. There were 8 million applicants, can you believe that?"
Sugar noticed the wall log and saw that its graphic display had gone dead. The words "standby" floated in the middle of the screen. She blinked up her lashboard and selected a speech link to Lizzie in the salon. It refused to connect.
"My lashboard's glitching," she said. "You might be right."
"The robots are down too," the doctor said, nodding towards the galley's artificials.
He went back out into the corridor. Sugar followed, and the Follow Me, clearly made of sterner stuff than the galley units, sped after her. The doctor took the stairs of the companionway two at a time, his hands sliding up the rails. He arrived on the executive salon deck.
"Oh," he said.
Sugar was halfway up the companionway steps behind him.
"What?" she asked. "Oh, what?"
He turned to look back down at her, his face very serious.
"Promise me you won't get upset," he said.
"Upset? Yes, promise me." "Upset about what?" she asked.
"Just promise me, Sugar."
She pushed past him, reached the top of the steps, and gazed out into the executive salon. There were drinks standing on tables, half-eaten bowls of macadamia nuts, and barely touched meals. But the executive salon was empty.
"But that's not..." she began. "I mean, I was just..." she added. "It can't all have
She fumbled. She looked at the doctor.
"Where have they all gone?" she asked.
He fixed her with a solemn and resolved gaze, bending his slender frame down so that they were eye to eye, and there was absolutely no doubt the gaze was entirely aimed at her.
"Sugar, I have no idea," the doctor said.
"Well, I have a tiny idea. Well, actually quite a big idea, but the important thing is that I'm going to work it out for sure, and then I'm going to find them. All of them, okay?"
Sugar nodded.
The follow me, having climbed the companionway stairs after her, sat down at her feet and waited patiently.
"How many people were travelling up here?" the doctor asked.
79 transfer clients," she said.
"Passengers, you mean?"
"Yes, 79 up here in executive, plus 6 comfort mediators," she said.
"Okay, you said up here, where else?" he asked.
740 transfer clients down below in Maine, along with several dozen more mediators."
The doctor sucked air thoughtfully through bared teeth.
"They can't just have vanished, can they?" Sugar asked.
"Well, apparently," he said. "The cosmos is a funny old place. Things appear and disappear all the time. You'd be amazed. One moment the thing's there, and then next it's not, and then pop, it's back again, and none the worse for wear."
"Really?"
"Oh, yes," he said. "It's nothing to be worried about. Take me, I'm always vanishing. It's difficult to stop me doing it, to be honest. Here one minute, gone the next, and it's never done me any harm."
She stared at him, not sure what to say.
He leaned forward and straightened her winged helmet. "That's a terrific hat," he said.
The doctor turned and hurried back towards the companionway. "The main deck down here, is it?" he called over his shoulder. Sugar ran after him, caught up, and led him down through the interdeck area into the main salon below. It was an area considerably larger than the chic executive deck, and the seats, though upholstered in neo-leather and very luxurious, were packed much more closely together. Nevertheless, the main deck was as devoid of life as the executive salon.
"Well, that sorted that out then," said the doctor.
"What?"
"You and me," he said. "We're the only people on this ship who haven't taken it upon themselves to up and vanish today."
"Can you hear that noise?" she asked.
"The engines, you mean? Yeah, they still don't sound happy, do they?"
"No, the other noise. The far away noise," she said.
"Far away?" he asked.
"Like voices calling out from a long way off. I don't know. Like the noise in my auntie's chimney."
"In your auntie's what?" the doctor asked.
"Never mind, nothing, but can't you hear it?"
He frowned. "Like distant voices crying out from a very long way away?" he asked.
"Yes."
"No, I can't," he said, "but that doesn't mean you can't. Auditory interstitial echoes could be part of this phenomenon. Whether you can hear them or not could depend on how neurotypical your mind is."
"What are you saying exactly?" she asked.
"I'm many things, Sugar Macaulay, but neurotypical has never been one of them. Let me know if it gets any louder, or if you can tell where it's coming from."
"Okay," she said.
The doctor tapped his lips with his index finger as he thought hard.
"Now listen," he said. "I'm going to ask you a couple of important questions, and I don't want you to panic unnecessarily about the answers."
"All right," she said.
"How long is this flight scheduled to last?"
94 minutes," she replied.
She blinked up her lashboard.
"And we're right on timetable, ETA 11 minutes and 15 seconds.
"Which answers my second question, thank you," he said. "Now, my third, is this ship's flight deck crewed or automated?"
"Well, it's crewed," Sugar replied. "Captain Kamal Gupta and his executive cooperators are..."
Her voice tailed off.
"Oh my God," she cried. "If everyone's vanished, who's flying this thing?"
They ran down the narrow throat of a corridor that connected the forward service alcove to the flight deck. The follow me zipped along behind them.
"We're going to crash," Sugar cried.
"No, we're not," the doctor replied.
"Yes, we are," Sugar cried. "Oh, dear God, if everyone has vanished, then the crew has vanished too. We'll crash. We'll crash land."
"We really, really won't," the doctor insisted.
"Why not?"
They had reached the sealed hatch that connected the flight deck to the main areas of the vehicle.
"Well," said the doctor, "for a start, we're not moving, so we can't crash. We're effecting an interstitial transposition because, as you so accurately advised me, this is an interstitial transposition vehicle. Our own quantum location is anchored. It's the rest of space-time that's whizzing around. Secondly, we're not likely to crash. You said we were heading to somewhere called Eternity."
Sugar nodded.
"Terminal station and Eternity. It's the furthest most Empire colony world, right out in the Lesser Magellanic Cloud."
"Okay, we're not going to crash land on Eternity."
"We're not?"
she asked. The doctor shook his head.
"No. In fact,
The problem is more that we're not going to crash or land on anything. We're slipping through interstitial space, the space between quantum dimensions. Well, it's slipping around us. Anyway, the real problem is that unless we regain control and begin to steer this thing, we could keep going forever. And I mean forever, in a very infinite sense.
Oh my God, she said.
The doctor hit the hatch release. There was an electronic whimper and the hatch remained shut.
It won't let me in, the doctor said.
The flight deck is security sealed, she replied. Do you have a key, a code?
Sugar shook her head. The doctor dropped to his knees and aimed his little pen-shaped device at the lock mechanism.
What is that?
Sugar asked.
Sonic screwdriver, the doctor replied.
The device was emitting a high-pitched tone.
And what does it do? She asked.
Usually better than this, the doctor growled and took the screwdriver away from the door. He slapped it twice, hard against his palm, and retrained it.
With a squeal, the hatch opened. Sugar had never been on the flight deck before, not even during training or the familiarization tours. It was a sleek place that looked as important as it was. There were 6 crew positions, big, high-backed accelerator seats upholstered in black leather. 2 faced forward, the others were arranged around the sides of the cabin. There was a bewildering array of consoles and displays, all writhing with graphically expressed streams of data. The consoles were set into a cabin finished in a designer excess of polished black glass and padded black leather. The 2 main crew positions faced a large hollow screen that curved down from the low ceiling and fulfilled the role of the cockpit's windscreen. Electronically represented contour graphics were whipping past the screen's point of view at a dizzying rate, suggesting that they were plunging and swerving along a deep winding tunnel or ravine. At last, Sugar got some sense of them being in motion, wild, headlong motion. Unfortunately, Captain Gupta and his cooperators were not fulfilling their roles as flight crew. The seats were all empty. A gold-crested captain's cap lay on the deck beside one of the positions. Matte black control paddles on steering columns waggled and twitched on automatic. Sugar heard distant sounds again. This time she thought it was probably the panic in her heart. With a little hum of gyros, the follow me trickled onto the flight deck at her heels. The doctor darted to one of the forward seats and sat down. Stretching out his fingers like a pianist preparing to play, he looked the consoles and column controls in front of him up and down.
All right, he said, more to himself than anything. Mirror horn wipers.
Tell me you can drive this thing,
Sugar said. I can drive this thing, he replied.
Yeah, only tell me something if it's actually true.
I do like your hat, he said.
The doctor took hold of the twitching control paddles in front of him. He seemed to resist his grip. He leaned over and tentatively adjusted some console settings. Several indicator lights changed colour.
Ah, I see, he said.
See what? She asked.
If you press that, the doctor said, that light changes from red to green.
Meaning what?
He shrugged. I don't know, but green's more reassuring than red, don't you think? Sugar flopped down in the seat beside him and put her head in her hands.
We're all going to die, she said.
Sadly, yes, he replied, but not today.
An alert notice sounded, and a seriously emphatic message window lit up on the main screen. It said, ETA Eternity Terminal Station 5 minutes. Begin ESLAM engine decycle.
What does that mean? Asked Sugar. Is that good?
It means it's time to decelerate the transpositional engines or we'll overshoot, he said. Well, the universe will overshoot us, but the effect will be the same.
So shut them down, she said.
It's not that simple. We need to decelerate to the right quantum harmonic, to the right frequency of reality, if you like.
And if we don't? She asked.
Well, then there's a danger we might pop back into reality inside something.
Something like what? She asked.
Oh, another ship, a building, a mountain, a star, he said.
We don't want that to happen, do we? She asked.
It's not high on my list of things to do, no. The problem is the controls are locked. I think the bump knocked them back to factory settings. They're stuck on some sort of default and they're not going to decycle by themselves.
He looked at her.
Is there access to the engines? Is there any access to the engines themselves? He asked.
She shook her head.
The engine chambers are sealed. It's a security thing. Novi Lunar didn't want anybody stealing the design secrets, she said.
The doctor beat his fingertips against his lips furiously.
So there's not enough time. There's not enough time to rig the engines or redo the calculations, and we can't overshoot and we mustn't shut down or...
Splat,
she said. "So, we'll have to improvise," he said. "We'll have to be clever. Let's be breathtakingly clever, shall we, Sugar Macaulay?" "Okay," she said. The doctor leapt up and crossed to one of the crew positions on the left-hand side of the flight deck. "Engineering," he said. He punched some keys and called up the holoprojection of a flow diagram. His fingers began to move faster and faster across the engineer's keypad. Complex algorithms started to superimpose themselves across the diagram. "Basically, we've got to put our foot on the clutch," he said as he typed.
"The what? I don't know what that is. What does it look like?" asked Sugar.
"Don't worry, I didn't mean it literally," said the doctor. "A clutch is an old-fashioned mechanical device, long before your time. You used to find them in old motor vehicles. Basically, when you put your foot on the clutch, it disengaged the drivetrain linking the engine to the wheels. The engines would still be running, but the power wouldn't be reaching the wheels. See?"
"We don't even have any wheels," said Sugar.
"No, no, we don't. We have interstitial field generation pods. 8 of them, it looks like. They take quantum power from the engines and use it to manipulate reality sliding it around us. But," he added, "for the purposes of right now, think of them as wheels. You know that button I pressed that made the red light go green?"
"This one?" she called back.
"That's it," he said. "Get ready to press it again when I tell you."
"When will that be?" she asked.
"Now," he said. Sugar pressed the button. The light went red. There was no lurch, or bump, or jolt, or protesting shriek of shredding hull metal.
"Nothing happened," she said.
The doctor smiled.
"Yes, and it's still not happening," he said.
He pointed up at the main holoscreen. The contoured graphic on display had stopped rushing past them like a tunnel or a canyon. It had frozen, with just the faintest sense of them drifting about on the spot.
"The quantum engines are still running," said the doctor.
"So we haven't made an unscheduled and messy reintegration with reality, but the power's not reaching the manipulator, so we've effectively stopped the universe from moving around us. We're coasting. We're floating. We're on pause."
"How long can we stay like this?" asked Sugar.
"As long as the engines keep running," said the doctor. "Which is a while yet. Long enough for me to do some serious remedial work and bring this ship in for a safe landing." He grinned and got to his feet. "So, allons-y, let's crack open these famous engines and take a proper look at them."
Sugar followed the doctor off the flight deck and back down the forward corridor to the executive salon. The Follow Me followed her. Pink light continued to flicker around the windows. In the main aisle, she saw a winged chrome hat lying on the carpet. She picked it up and fought back tears that seemed to ambush her from nowhere.
"This was Lizzie's," she said.
"She had a good taste in hats too," the doctor replied.
"Will I ever see her again?" Sugar asked him.
"Oh, absolutely," he replied. "I absolutely guarantee it."
Suddenly, he clutched her wrist. He was looking down the length of the salon towards the service alcove.
"What is it?" she asked.
"I don't know," he whispered. "But it just moved."
They stole forwards together, softly. The doctor hunched down below headrest level like a poacher stalking his prey. Sugar followed suit. The Follow Me scudded along behind her.
"What did you see?" she hissed.
"Just movement. Just a flash of movement," he said. He pointed down there.
They scurried along the aisle a little further, and then the doctor switched sideways through 2 seating nests onto the left-hand aisle. Sugar followed him. Someone said her name. She froze and felt fear prickle her skin. The doctor looked back at her.
"What?"
he asked, his voice low. "What's the matter?"
"Did you just call my name?" she asked.
"No,"
he said. "Don't worry then," she told him. "I'm obviously just going crazy."
"No, you're not," he said. "Remember I said that auditory interstitial echoes could be part of this phenomenon?"
"Yes."
"Well, they could."
He whirled around. "It's still moving," he whispered.
He dropped onto his hands and knees and peered under the executive salon's expensive hand-tooled leather seats. Sugar edged after him cautiously. She heard something. Not her name this time, but an animal growl.
It came out from between the seats at them, teeth bared. It was an ugly thing, hairless and wrinkled, with slack beige flesh, red eyes and stub ears. It was also less than 40 centimetres long and wearing a diamante collar. Oh, my God! Sugar cried. The doctor ducked, and the snarling thing flew over his head and bounced off a seat back. It yelped. Sugar grabbed at it and missed. She finally managed to seize it by the leash it was trailing. I've got it! She cried. The doctor jerked upright on his knees and stared at the yapping, snarling thing in her hands.
It's one of the Dowager Colette's luck dogs, she cried. She had three of them, yappy little things.
This Dowager, she was one of the passengers.
She was an executive transfer client in 31 over there, Sugar said, pointing. Mega rich.
There was a rumour that she'd actually bought her way on board and not done the lottery like everyone else.
Sorry, lottery? Asked the doctor. Everyone wanted to travel on the maiden voyage, said Sugar. So there was a lottery.
She held the little animal up by its armpits and looked into its yapping face.
I am also pleased to see you, she told it.
It certainly presents a question, said the doctor. Has it been hiding here all the time, or did it vanish and come back?
Sugar put the luck dog down on the seat cushion. She hadn't thought about it that way. If the Dowager's dog had vanished and reappeared, she felt sort of funny touching it or holding it, as it might contaminate her with the residue of whatever had made it vanish. The luck dog looked up at her and yapped in protest.
When you said vanish, what exactly did you mean?
Asked the man standing behind them. Sugar and the doctor both turned to face him in surprise. The luck dog yapped wildly. Sugar recognised the man immediately. It was the strange, quiet man who'd been travelling alone in Booth 8, Zone 8, the one Lizzie had thought was cute, the one she'd joked was a secret agent or something. He was quite cute, now Sugar looked at him. He was a compact, well-proportioned man, with short salt-and-pepper hair. He was wearing a simple slate-grey suit, and his eyes had a slightly wicked, mischievous twinkle in them.
I said, he repeated, you said vanish, and I wonder what you meant by it.
Oh, well, the doctor began. He stopped. Sorry, he said. Where did you come from? The man in the grey suit gestured over his shoulder with his thumb. Booth 8, I think it is, just over there. There was a bump, and then everybody vanished. Except you pair, he added. And that guy over there. He pointed. In the seating nest that Joseph Stearns Cluxton and his boisterous party had been occupying, a mousy little man was getting up from the floor. He was blinking and steadying himself on the armrest as if he'd been sleeping off a terrible hangover under the seat. It was the man that Sugar had been told was Cluxton's official biographer.
Sugar? Said the doctor gently, nodding at the waking man. Why don't you go and mediate his comfort?
Sugar nodded and hurried over to Cluxton's seating area. The follow me and the luck dog trotted after her. She spoke to the mousy little man and helped him to a seat. He looked bewildered. The doctor turned back to the man in the grey suit.
Sorry, he said. Sorry, where were we? Oh, yes, I'm the doctor.
He held out his hand. Reston, replied the man in the grey suit, shaking it.
Oh, said the doctor. Mister? Captain? The Right Honourable? His Holiness?
Well, Mister, I suppose, the man said. The doctor nodded.
Mr. Reston, we've got a bit of a situation, he said, in that 90+% of the ship's passengers seem to have disappeared. Asked Reston.
That would be a large part of it, the doctor agreed.
Disappeared where? Asked Reston.
And that would be most of the rest of it, said the doctor.
They walked over to where Sugar was sitting with the mousy little man. The man was sipping a glass of water that Sugar had poured for him. He looked properly befuddled.
This is Mr. Lars Bortnick, Sugar told them. He's Mr. Cluxton's official biographer.
Bortnick looked up at the doctor and Reston.
Where is Mr. Cluxton? He asked. I'm supposed to shadow him at all times.
The doctor ignored the question and instead asked, What happened?
Bortnick shrugged. I was just sitting there, he said. Mr. Cluxton was telling us a particularly amusing story about his early days as a lab assistant at Mars Tech. I was making notes. He likes to make sure I record his anecdotes, you see.
Bortnick hesitated.
Where's my notebook? He asked, a sudden pang of anxiety on his face. Has anybody seen my notebook? It's really very valuable.
We'll find it in a minute, the doctor assured him. You were saying?
Bortnick wiped his nose nervously on the back of his hand. Mr. Cluxton was telling the story, and then there was a tremendous bump and a bright flash, and then I was on the floor.
Is that all you remember? Asked Reston.
Yes, Bortnick nodded. No, no, there is something else. Between the bright flash and me finding myself on the floor, I distinctly remember that someone called my name.
Sugar glanced at the doctor in concern.
Oh my God, said Bortnick. There hasn't been some kind of accident, has there?
How long was it? The doctor asked, squatting in front of Bortnick so that he could look him in the eyes.
How long? Bortnick echoed. Between the bump and the flash and you finding yourself on the floor, how long would you say?
Well, a second, 5 seconds, no real time at all.
The doctor rose. He rubbed his hands together thoughtfully and looked around. They've come back, he said to himself quietly.
An anguished cry tore the air and made them jump. The cry had come from the seat nests at the far end of the salon. The doctor started running in that direction, and Sugar and Reston followed him. The follow-me whirred off in Sugar's wake, and the luck dog, barking and snapping, chased after it, with its leash trailing. Bortnick rose from his seat as if to go with them, and then flopped back down with a miserable groan. A young woman was sitting in one of the salon-end nests. She'd been hidden from them by the high seat backs. She was sobbing and shaking. Oh, now, don't cry, the doctor told her as he skidded up beside her. Everything's really all right, honest.
Where's Adam? She sobbed. Where is he? He was right here, and then he wasn't.
We'll find him, the doctor told her. What's your name?
Adam and Jay Sylvian, said Sugar, travelling together, honeymoon couple.
What's happening? The girl cried, tears streaming down her cheeks. Where's Adam? Where's everyone? Oh, God, this was supposed to be the trip of a lifetime.
It really, really will be, said the doctor. He looked around at Reston. Mr. Reston, you look like a reliable, dependable sort of person to me.
And? Asked Reston.
Perhaps you'd sit with Jay here for a moment while she calms herself down.
Why? Where are you going?
Asked Reston as he sat down beside the upset girl.
Sugar and I are going to check the main salon, said the doctor.
They've come back, the doctor told Sugar quietly as they hurried towards the companionway.
What?
They must have vanished and come back again, he explained. We could have missed one person, but not three, and a dog. So, some of the people who vanished have returned.
Are you sure? She asked.
Pretty sure. Think about what Mr. Bortnick told us. He felt the bump and saw the flash just like we did, but to him it was only a few seconds later that he saw us.
He might have been unconscious, she suggested.
He might have been. But he did hear someone calling his name, she said.
He did, the doctor agreed.
They were coming down the steps into the main salon.
Doctor, said Sugar, I can hear voices.
They stepped out into the main salon. A crowd of more than 20 people had congregated to the main aisle, and they were milling in anxious debate. As soon as they caught sight of Sugar and the doctor, they mobbed towards them. Steady now, steady, the doctor cried, flapping his arms to try to calm their rapid-fire questions. Leading the group was the young comfort mediator in the blue uniform who had bumped into Sugar outside the provision store.
Oh, I'm so glad to see you, she exclaimed and hugged Sugar tightly. We were about to come up to executive to see if there was anybody there. What's happening?
Sugar gently disengaged herself from the hug and looked to the doctor.
Who's this then? Asked the doctor.
Millie,
the girl in blue announced and embraced the doctor as well.
Okay, hugging, said the doctor.
Millie, thought Sugar, not Molly, but I was pretty close.
What is happening? Demanded one of the group members, a red-faced, middle-aged man.
Well, we're working on that, said the doctor.
Are you in charge?
The man pressed.
No, I'm just helping out, said the doctor.
He's the doctor, said Sugar.
You're the on-board doctor? An old lady piped up. Oh, thank goodness. I bruised my elbow in that bump. Something nasty.
Did we crash?
Asked a teenage boy in a hollow-weave T-shirt.
No, we didn't, said Sugar.
What do we do then? Asked the red-faced man. Did we arrive?
No, we didn't do that either, said Sugar.
Where did everybody else go?
Asked another man, and several voices joined in support of the question.
Why do I keep hearing someone saying my name? Asked the teenage boy.
The doctor looked at him. What is your name? He asked.
Lincoln Tang,
the boy replied. His shirt's hollow print showed a 3D shot of Sky hockey players in action, and then shifted into the numbered vest of his favourite player.
Hello, Lincoln, said the doctor. And what's your name? He asked, turning to look at the red-faced man.
Charles Anders, the man replied.
And yours? The doctor asked the old lady. Monica Westlake, she replied. My elbow's very sore.
And you're all passengers, I mean transfer clients, except you, Millie.
Millie nodded. The doctor continued to go around the group asking names.
You'll never remember them all, Sugar thought. But as the doctor began to talk to them, it was quite clear he had. He used their names and answered their questions in gently deflecting ways to calm them down. Even Anders, the belligerent red-faced man, seemed to relax a little.
Let's get everyone upstairs, the doctor said to Sugar and Millie.
Into executive? Asked one of the passengers excitedly.
Into executive, Joyce, the doctor said to her. That'll be nice, won't it?
Millie and I can get some snacks and drinks organised, said Sugar.
That'd be a good idea, said the doctor. In the meantime, I'm going to take a look at these engines.
Alone, the doctor wandered aft into the engineering section of the prototype vehicle. Ever since he'd improvised a way of setting the experimental drive to coast, the engines had been making yet another different noise. Not the murmur of standard running, nor the protesting struggle that had followed the bump. Now it was more of a floating, tremulous warble, unfocused and unsettled. The aft service areas of the ship were functional, gloomy spaces with half-standard lighting and no carpeting or wall finish. A locked hatch into the engineering section had been printed with a long list of persons prohibited from entering by order of Novi Lunar Corporation. He had to use the sonic screwdriver to open the hatch. It took a little longer to open the hermetically sealed valve that led from the service section through to the main engineering compartment. The doctor found himself in a very large chamber, larger even than the main salon deck. It extended at least three decks deep, and the levels were connected by cage gantries, catwalks, and modular frame steps. A green gloom filled the whole chamber. The air in the compartment throbbed with the wash of the engine noise. The two huge transpositional engines, Joseph Stern's Cluxton's great invention, were encased in gigantic ovoid shells, like immense armoured eggs. The doctor approached one and rested his hand against the shell plating. He could feel the vibration, but there was no sense of heat bleed. He went around the engine pod, examining it carefully. It was clear that the armoured shell, rather than encasing the engine, was only there to keep prying eyes and industrial spies away. The casing was plastered with warning notices and injunctions to anyone without the appropriate security clearance to stay away. There weren't even any monitor stations or diagnostic consoles through which you could study the engine's operation. The whole of engineering was automated. Dormant artificials lurked in the shadows. These were humanoid models, like the units that worked in the galley. The doctor pottered about for a few minutes, double-checking that he hadn't missed any inspection ports or similar access points to the engine cases. He hummed an aimless, reassuring refrain that he belatedly realised began to echo the tuneless melody of the engine's plaintive murmur.
Odd, he thought.
He went back to the artificials and approached the nearest one, which was standing in its recharging wall bracket. By this period in the history of the human race, robotic technologies had reached a sophisticated level. The artificial was functional and ergodynamic in appearance. It hadn't been constructed to resemble a human being. Its maker certainly hadn't intended anyone to mistake it for a person. It had simply been designed to mimic human physical actions to an extremely fine degree of motor skill, and thus replace the need for human technicians or workers. Built into the unit's chest was an advanced multitask scanning tool, and its hands were soft polymer pads containing powerful electromagnetic manipulators in place of digits. The doctor used a sonic screwdriver to remove the artificial's blank faceplate, a dome of pearlescent ceramic. He began to examine the exposed interior of pressed aluminium and solid-state circuits. Then he stood back for a moment, with his arms folded, and stared at the artificial thoughtfully.
Credit for them? Asked Sugar.
The doctor looked around and then up. Sugar was standing on one of the catwalks overhead, looking down at him.
I thought I'd come and see how you were getting on, Sugar said, coming down the steps to join him.
She looked around, taking in the spectacle of the compartment.
I've never been in here before, she said, impressed. It's quite a place.
How are the passengers? The doctor asked.
Everyone's pretty calm. They're all in shock a little bit, to tell the truth, and they want to know what's really going on and when we're going to land safely, but Millie and I acted all confident and reassuring and handed out the macadamias and the complimentary drinks and basically told them it was a temporary hiccup and normal service would be resumed soon.
Well done, said the doctor.
Oh, and I checked on the flight deck to see if any of the crew had come back as well.
That was very clever thinking, the doctor told her.
She did a little mock curtsy.
Thank you.
Sadly, none of them had.
Ah,
said the doctor. So, she asked,
will it?
The doctor was poking about inside the artificial's face again.
Will what?
He asked. Will normal service be resumed soon? The doctor glanced over at her and said,
yes, if I've anything to do with it.
She came up behind him and peered over his shoulder as he worked.
Do you trust me?
She asked.
Of course I do.
And please tell me what's going on, doctor. He looked around at her.
Okay, Sugar Macaulay, he said. I think the problem is with these transposition engines.
He gestured at the giant murmuring ovoids.
These things generate exotic particle fields that, putting it simply, alter reality. They cause multidimensional reality to ripple open like a pack of cards being shuffled, and that allows this ship to pass through space-time.
And that's why everyone vanished?
I think so. I think the engines misfired for some reason, and an awful lot of people got accidentally shuffled sideways into an adjacent dimension.
And then some came back.
The doctor nodded. Yes. Then some came back, he said. They were reimposed. I don't know why. I don't know how. It's part of the malfunction.
And what are you doing with this artificial?
Asked Sugar.
The doctor walked over to one of the engine cases and thumped it hard.
That's about, 20 centimeter thick Calvinium. There are no cutting tools here and no entry or inspection points. Novi-Luna, it is Novi-Luna, isn't it?
Yes, she said.
Novi-Luna Corporation is clearly ultra-sensitive when it comes to protecting its industrial secrets. Sealed engine units. Automated engineering section. No human eyes allowed in case they steal Cluxton's great secret.
And?
She asked. And we need to reset the engines, said the doctor. We need to reset them from the default factory settings they've become stuck on because of the bump, so that we can decycle them and make a safe landing on Eternity. It's the only way to make sure everyone currently alive on this vessel stays alive.
What about everyone else? Sugar asked.
The doctor spun around sharply at a sudden noise. It was the Follow Me, slowly and diligently making its way down the gantry steps in a gallant effort to follow Sugar. It's your little friend, said the doctor.
I know, said Sugar. Don't avoid the question. What about everyone else?
I think if we can get these engines to decycle, it might be enough to correct the error. Everyone who's missing might simply be reimposed on this dimension safe and sound.
And how do we do that? She asked.
I'm working on it, he told her.
And what happens if it doesn't work?
Oh, come on, he exclaimed encouragingly. Where's your optimism? Where's your Novi-Luna corporate spirit? Of course it'll work. We'll get your friend Lizzie back. We'll get everyone back, safe and sound and large as life.
He took her by the hands and peered encouragingly into her eyes.
Hey, come on.
Hey.
I believe you, she said, smiling.
He had fallen silent. He was staring into her eyes, as if almost hypnotized. His hands clutched hers tightly. They were almost nose to nose.
Doctor, she breathed. Doctor.
That's it, he whispered.
What?
That's it, he exploded, hugging her tight and then doing a little victory dance. That's it, Sugar Macaulay, that's how we do it.
Do what? She asked.
Doctor? The answer was right there in your eyes. Well, your lashboard at least. Oh, that's brilliant.
What is?
She asked. I need to use this artificial to get at the engines, the doctor exclaimed, waggling a finger at the robot. But I had no idea how I was going to interface with it.
How are you going to interface with it?
She asked uncertainly. With your permission, he declared, I'll look through your eyes.
How does that feel? The doctor asked. No discomfort?
He just aimed a burst from his sonic screwdriver at her eyes for the third time in as many minutes.
Sugar's eyes felt slightly dry and prickly, but it wasn't too bad.
It's fine, she said. Good, we're all set, he said. Ready?
She nodded.
The doctor poked his sonic screwdriver into the artificial's exposed facial innards and adjusted something. Auto-reboot, he said.
The artificial suddenly jerked into life and stepped forward out of its recharging wall bracket.
I've set it to perform a simple diagnostic check, the doctor said to Sugar.
The artificial, its faceplate still off, paced across the compartment towards the nearest engine case with dutiful hydraulic purpose.
The Follow Me, hovering at Sugar's side, zipped back in alarm to get out of the larger artificial's path. The artificial reached the engine case and came to a halt with its chest-mounted scanning tool aimed at the case's surface. Then it planted its hand pads on the casing.
"You see?" said the Doctor excitedly. "It uses its scanner to look through the engine casing as if it was glass. It's examining the workings of the engine inside. And then it uses its electromagnetic manipulators to adjust, tweak and maintain the engine mechanisms through the case. It's really very clever."
"I'm sure it is," said Sugar.
"And this is where you come in," said the Doctor. "Blink up your lashboard."
"Got it?"
"Yes," said Sugar. "What do you see?"
"Oh, weird," she exclaimed.
"If it's working, you're seeing what the artificial is seeing," said the Doctor. "You should have the artificial's entire diagnostic control selection available to you."
I think that must be what I'm looking at," said Sugar.
"Now, here comes the breathtakingly clever part," the Doctor told her. "No. Here comes the stop whatever the heck it is you're doing part," said a voice from above them.
The Doctor and Sugar looked up in surprise. Reston was coming down the steps from the gantry towards them. The pistol he was aiming at them was small, black, and vicious-looking.
"Let me put it another way," Reston said, looking directly at the Doctor.
"Who are you?"
"I'm the Doctor," said the Doctor.
"He's the Doctor!" cried Sugar. "Where did you get a gun, Mr. Reston?"
"You," said Reston to Sugar.
"Hush a little."
"You?"
He looked at the Doctor. "You're not the onboard Doctor, I know that for a fact. I checked my lashboard files. The onboard Doctor was sitting in the main salon in 11-6. His name was Caden. You look nothing like him."
"I never said I was the onboard Doctor," the Doctor replied. "I never said that. I'm just the Doctor."
"Which Doctor?" asked Reston.
"Doctor who? You're so evasive."
"All I know is, you shouldn't be on this vessel."
"Neither should a weapon," Sugar cried. "Where did that come from?"
"He's Novi Luna Security, Sugar," said the Doctor, trying to keep her calm. "Isn't that right, Mr. Reston?"
Reston nodded. "Transit Marshal undercover," he said. "I'm taking control. I'm securing this situation now for the good of the remaining passengers. That starts with you, Doctor. You can't explain what you're doing on this ship, and you've forced entry to the confidential drive compartment. God alone knows what you've sabotaged."
"I've done nothing," the Doctor said, calmly.
Reston shrugged. "I wish I could believe you," he said. "But there are too many questions."
"Ask them,"
the Doctor replied.
Reston shrugged. "How'd you get aboard?" he asked.
"I have a trans-dimensional vehicle of my own. I landed in Provision Store 3, said the Doctor.
Reston snorted. "Okay, already you're lying. These engines are bleeding-edge technology, my friend. No one else in the Empire has a trans-dimensional vehicle."
"I never said I was from the Empire," said the Doctor.
That made Reston hesitate.
"So what are you?
An alien?" he asked.
"A Time Lord," said the Doctor.
"A what?
Is that like Santa Claus?" asked Reston.
"Don't be silly," the Doctor replied. "There is no Santa Claus. Well, there hasn't been one for about 7,000 years, anyway."
"You think this is funny now?" asked Reston.
The Doctor shook his head.
"No, Mr. Reston, I think this is very serious," he said. "There is a potential threat to the lives of everyone travelling on this ship today. Help me protect them, Reston."
"I haven't finished asking the questions," Reston replied.
"Why are you here?"
"Oh, don't we all ask ourselves that once in a while?"
Reston sighed. "This constant evasion is starting to annoy me," he said.
"Just put the gun down, please," said the Doctor.
"Don't tell me what to do," said Reston,
"and stop saying my name."
"I'm not saying your name."
"Stop it,"
Reston said through gritted teeth, his controlled professional calm suddenly leaving him. His eyes began to grow wider, and he started to brandish the gun threateningly.
"I said stop saying my name! Stop repeating it!"
"I'm not!" the Doctor cried.
He pushed Sugar behind him. "Trust me, I'm not. You're hearing echoes of something else. Concentrate on my voice. You're just experiencing some kind of audio distortion." Whatever he was hearing, it was making Reston panic. The Doctor was afraid the gun was about to go off accidentally. Reston was almost yelling, "Stop saying my name!" Then the Doctor heard something else. A thin, plaintive sound like someone calling from a long way off.
"Do you hear that?"
Sugar asked.
This time I do, the doctor told her.
Oh my God, Sugar said.
She pointed. A ball of mercury, of molten glass, was spinning and forming in the air behind Reston, just like the thing that Sugar had seen in Provision Store 1. Soft and gleaming, it was extruding into their reality. Blood and the impression of pulsing internal organs were already becoming visible in its glassy depths.
Good grief, said the doctor, stunned.
Reston turned and saw it. He let out a cry of dismay and recoiled. He fired his weapon at it. The expanding molten blob distorted in the air as the shot struck it. It rippled and deformed and then reformed, solidifying and growing very much more rapidly than before. The glassy skin was darkening and flushing through with colour. It had a form now. For a moment, Sugar thought it was human. But it was larger than a man, taller, broader in its shoulders, its neck hunched forward, its limbs and torso lean and skeletal. No head or face had yet formed or even begun to spin out of the glassy matter. Blood and pink organs moved inside the slowly solidifying body. The noise of distant voices had become almost deafening, like a host of frightened people crying out for salvation. Run, the doctor said to Sugar. But, she began. The thing lashed out with one of its arms. The arm had no hand or digits. It had not finished forming. The forearm simply tapered into a transparent, glassy stump of forming wrist. It snagged against Reston's shoulder as he tried to back away. Where it touched him, Reston immediately began to vanish, to turn into that swirling, glassy substance. He screamed as the molten quicksilver effect spread across him, evaporating him from the shoulder outwards, making his clothes and flesh translucent and then entirely transparent to reveal glimpses of skeleton and muscle. And then he simply melted. The doctor grabbed Sugar by the hand. I said, run! As the unfortunate Mr. Reston evaporated, Sugar shrieked in horror and looked away, not wishing to have a picture of the ghastly process burned into her memory. Then the doctor had her by the hand. He was holding her tight, yelling at her to run. She could just hear his voice above the fearful echo of phantom voices. He pulled her back across the engine compartment and they began to run. Reston evaporated away. The last glassy relics of his form shivered apart into empty air. His gun hit the deck, and the impact caused it to misfire into a bulkhead. The entity, alert and aware, surged after them. The doctor and Sugar ran deeper into the compartment, following the line of one of the massive engine pods. They could hear the distant voices still, but they could also hear heavy, dull impacts of the entity moving behind them. Footsteps, the doctor whispered, as he dragged Sugar under the end of one of the engine assemblies and back down the far side of the compartment. We can hear its footsteps.
So,
Sugar wailed, that means it's solid, said the doctor. It's through. It's here. Sugar glared at him, uncomprehending. He shushed her and got them into cover behind a rack of recharging artificials. The entity continued to prowl. Sugar could hear its heavy, leaden footsteps echoing around the large chamber. Deck plates creaked and protested under its weight. She could no longer see it directly because it was on the other side of the engine assembly. It had become a hulking shadow, a lurching mass of blackness in the gloom, like a giant animal lost in the darkness of a cave. It continued to move about for another few minutes, occasionally coming close to where they were hiding, and then moving away again. The doctor kept his index finger pressed to his lips, but Sugar didn't need any encouragement to keep silent. Sheer terror had robbed her of just about every word she'd ever known how to say. Then it grew quieter. The sound of distant voices receded until it became just a faint, sad whisper. There were no more footsteps. Slowly, wearily, the doctor leaned out of their hiding place and took a look. He stepped out of cover and began to scout the area.
"I think it's gone," he whispered.
"Gone where? Is it heading for the salons?"
"No, no," said the doctor. "I think it's left our wavelength. I think it's gone back to wherever it came from."
"Vanished, you mean?" asked Sugar.
The doctor nodded.
"That's what I saw, you know," said Sugar.
"What?"
"When it started to appear, those shiny swirling shapes. That's what I saw in Provision Store 1, said Sugar. "I think Millie saw them too. Is that thing responsible for all this?"
The doctor looked thoughtful.
"I'm not sure," he replied. "I think what we saw was an entity trying to achieve a transposition into our dimension. It worked long enough for it to be solid for a few minutes."
"So it could be appearing for the same reason that everybody disappeared?" she asked.
"Yes," said the doctor.
"So it's trying to hurt us? Trying to get at us?"
"Not necessarily."
"It just killed Mr. Reston," Sugar cried.
"I'm not entirely sure it did," replied the doctor. "It's certainly dangerous, but it might not mean to be dangerous. But it touched Reston while it was in the middle of transposing. I think he got caught up in the effect. I don't think it killed him. It just shuffled him back to its own origin point."
"What if you're wrong?" Sugar asked.
"Oh, come on," the doctor protested lightly. "Do I look like the sort of person who's wrong on any kind of regular basis?"
"I'd like to get out of here, please," Sugar said.
"Very soon," the doctor promised. "We just need to finish what we were doing. It's important."
"Okay," she said.
"We'll make it quick," he added. "In case, you know..."
"What?"
"In case it comes back and I'm wrong," he said.
They retraced their steps towards the artificial that the doctor had rebooted. Sugar eyed every shadow and patch of gloom with misgivings, expecting each one to move and come for her. Then one moved. Sugar screamed. The "follow me" skidded to a halt at her feet. Sugar scolded the little artificial, using a number of words forbidden for crew use in the Novi Lunar Staff handbook. The engineering artificial, its faceplate off, was still standing beside one of the engine cases. It had completed its diagnostic check and had switched to sleep mode while it waited for new instructions. The doctor used his sonic screwdriver to reset Sugar's lashboard again. She kept glancing around nervously.
"Try to keep looking at me," he encouraged her.
"Okay."
"Right," he said, snapping off the device. "Just like before, you should be seeing what the artificial is seeing. You should have the artificial's entire diagnostic control selection available to you."
She nodded.
"Yes," she said. "Yes, I have."
"All right," he said. He adjusted the setting of his screwdriver and aimed it at her eyes again. The screwdriver emitted a short burst. Sugar's eyes lit up. Pale beams of light projected from her eyes and formed a graphic image in mid-air in front of her. "I'm using the actuators in your eyelashes to direct the holographic image outward so I can see it too," said the doctor.
"You can see what I'm seeing?"
"I certainly can," said the doctor.
He leant forward and studied the floating, gently fizzling graphic menu. "Diagnostic control selection. Perfect. Okay, Sugar, follow my finger. You see this? Where it says transposition setting reselect? Blink on that."
Sugar blinked.
"Brilliant. Now, look down this submenu here and blink on decycle protocols."
"Okay,"
she said, making her focus adjust.
"Blink on it?"
"Yes, perfect."
"It's asking me authorize yes, no," said Sugar.
"Blink to accept yes," said the doctor.
"Done. Now, focus right to bring up that menu there. Yes, good. Now, blink on enable standard engine decycle."
"Done," she said.
There was a subtle change in the sound of the engines on either side of them. The doctor began to grin. He aimed his sonic screwdriver at Sugar and shut off the hologram projecting from her eyes. She blinked a couple more times, rubbed her eyes, and looked at him.
"Did it work?"
she asked. The engines can now be decycled safely from the flight deck, the doctor grinned.
We can bring this ship into land.
What's happening? Millie asked as they rushed back through the executive salon. The passengers, even the dreary Lars Bortnick, got to their feet as soon as they saw the doctor reappear and hurried towards him. They were full of questions.